Holding Court with Mike Trevelyan and Dean Sheridan. Hi, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of Holding Court with myself, Dean Sheridan, and my barrister friend, Michael Trevelyan. In this podcast, we like to look over some crazy court cases, some fun court cases, crimes, etc., and discuss them. And hopefully, Mike will teach us something along the way. How are you, Michael?
I'm well, thank you. Yeah, I've had a sort of busy few days. We are recording on a Sunday morning, and I've spent sort of Friday and Saturday chilling out, seeing friends, having a bit to drink, having some good food. And so now I'm in that kind of place where I feel like I just need a little bit of quiet time, a little bit of Bovril, bed by 9 o'clock, and it's going to be excellent. I should say, this is as much a message to you, Deans, to our dear listeners, but it may impact them as well, that I have the door to my office from where I record open. Normally it's closed. The reason it's open is because I have put up about 20 minutes ago a big mirror on my landing, and I've sort of screwed it in, and I am concerned that it's going to fall down. So if we hear a big crash or a clunk, it will be my mirror collapsing, and I will have to go and see the damage.
It will also be 7 years of bad luck.
Well, exactly, yes. I mean, it's high stakes. That's not going to lie to you. But I did want a mirror in my landing. So what are you going to do? Yeah.
I know you said that your mood last time is relevant on what the weather is like. So
yes,
today, well, at least where I am, it's a little bit grey and miserable, though still quite humid. How is this affecting you, Michael?
It's made me rather melancholic. I'm like a black velvet painting come to life, and I'm just sort of being very, very sad, a little bit moody, a little bit grumpy. But it's all fine, because soon the clouds will break, both metaphorically and literally. And then suddenly I will feel much improved, and then everything will be great. So, you know, it's all good. I do need to get one of those daylight lamp things, let's be honest. But the good thing, I think, is because it hasn't rained in a while. And I think the thing that gets me is the kind of gloomy rain. This kind of light but cloudy is fine. I can live with that. That's absolutely acceptable weather.
So I would say it looks like there's probably some sort of sun hiding behind the clouds in the sky. I can see it sort of poking through, but it's just not being allowed to shine.
No, exactly. I'll tell you what, there was something quite sexy about when you just said that, and I was thinking to myself, blimey, Dean would make a very, very good sexy weatherman.
That'll be great, actually. I might have to send an application into the BBC. Well, I'll start a bit lower. Maybe I'll just be the Channel 5 weatherman for a while first.
Yeah, maybe.
Before we'll build up. Over here, we have a hurricane.
Many people will likely die.
Yeah, I don't know why I have to be monotonous at the same time.
is that how we both do sexy, is just by being incredibly monotonous? And
turn into a robot. Hello, baby. You look very nice.
It is time for sexy time. Beep,
That's why I've always been so successful with the women. Like, just the way he speaks like a robot. I just can't control myself.
Yeah, I do get worried that I'm going to get replaced by a Roomba at some point in the future. A much more successful robot than I've ever managed to be.
Yeah, and it does to clean it up.
Well, exactly. But how are you doing? Because you have just bought a gaming computer, so you must be just wrapping it around you, frolicking on the floor with your motherboard, and just living the dream.
I am, but I'm still using my old rubbish laptop right now to record, so there's a very expensive bit of kit right next to me just going to waste, but that's because I don't have a webcam for it yet.
So not, dear listener, because he doesn't think you're worth it.
No, I would much rather use it, as it took about half an hour just to load the computer up and get it prepared for the episode. But everything else is on here, so I'll have to still use this for a while until I'm fully webcammed up, because we just couldn't go without seeing each other's faces whilst we do this.
Exactly. It wouldn't have worked. We can now actually think about doing this in person, I presume. But I don't know what the mechanics of that will be. I don't know actually if that's easier or harder for you with the recording. I don't know how it works.
I don't know how it works either. It's good to show our technical knowledge of podcasts over.
Dear listener, if you know how we can make this work, then please email us and we will then make it work.
I will do some research now I have the hardware. And I guess it will just be about not hearing each other's voices, which sounds like a really, really obvious thing.
Yes, I mean, presumably, presumably we will have to hear each other's voices, because otherwise we simply won't know what the other person is saying. But because we're in the same place, that problem is going to resolve itself, because we will hear each other through the magic of acoustics rather than technology.
I was just worried that one microphone picks up one voice, one microphone picks up the other. Maybe I'll just have to do a better job at editing. Maybe I'm just a lazy editor who just likes to put down one single track and just cut from it.
Maybe you are, Dean. Maybe you are.
So let's move on to the things that we're fantastic at. Is analysing these stories. So I recently had a visit to Nottingham, where we went to the Museum of Justice and was shown an old, I believe, Victorian court room, how it was set out, and it was quite interesting. But what I found interesting was how up against it you would have been back there. So, for instance, this is the case of George Bates. I'm not exactly 100% sure what year it is, but he was accused of stealing some silver spoons, and I think a couple of other spoons. This seemed to be the most upsetting thing, from his, I was about to say his master's house, but I would like to say employer's house.
Yes, yes. Well, why don't we fully embrace the sort of Victoriana atmosphere, and we should just start speaking in sort of old Victorian. So verily, he did stealeth the spoons.
Yes.
Well, that's he was accused.
Accused, I can't think that fast.
That's all right, you've nailed it so far.
And he doth proclaim his innocence. Eh?
Ooh,
there we go, that's a good one.
There we go, that was outstanding.
And we were shown ye oldie courtroom and explained how it would work. So, for instance, your judge would try and get through many, many cases in one day, rather than trial taking up to a few weeks, especially for the poorer folk. They would basically have one judge that would travel around, or a few judges that traveled around, and then they would turn up and they would just try and get through the backlog for a few weeks. So this was an average instance. All your jurors would be very rich men who would sit and pass judgment on all the poorer people. And
is it right that you had to own land to be on a jury? I've got a feeling you had to be a landowner of a certain acreage.
So, yeah,
so, I would assume that would be richer people.
I would assume that works with it. When we were there, they said these were all rich men, so that would be the case in that time. And they would sort of yay or nay it. And and whoever was pressing the charges seemed to be able to sort of say what they would like to happen. And then the judge would just agree. So in the case of George Bates, who stole the spoons, this man was so upset by the lack of spoons, maybe he went to have breakfast. His Cheerios were getting soggy. There was nothing to eat them with. He said, I would like him to be hanged. And they were like, all right, let's check with the jury. The jury seemed all right with that. And then George Bates was sent down. Literally down the steps at the back of the courtroom, which I think is where it comes from, that saying.
It is. Yeah, it is.
And he then tried to escape and created a sort of stereotypical rope from cloth and things that he tied together, the kind of thing you see in the movies. He managed to escape. Other people lined up and tried to escape at the same time, but were all caught by passers-by and sent back into the prison. George Bates had gone to run for 12 months, was caught again. I think he was found in Newcastle or something around there. And then he was brought back to Nottingham. But this time, the judge was far more lenient and just sent him to Australia. Instead of killing him. So he actually committed another crime and got a lesser sentence. And that is supposedly where the records of George Bates sort of cease to exist. There's probably a nice Bates family over in Australia. But yeah, so I thought it was kind of crazy that this you could walk up. It seems fun. I mean, if you're on the side that's been wronged, that you can walk in and say, you know what, I actually want this to happen. And then it's down to the jury. And very likely the jury would probably agree with you, as long as it wasn't too obscene. And supposedly the rate of guilty far outweighs the amount of innocent people found in that era. So I thought that was fun and worth talking about, like how this sort of changed and how we've now got the sort of legal system that has to abide by certain rules. And as you say, set guidelines for years or sentences based on crimes rather than he stole my spoons. Can we hang him, please? And depending on who you've got as the judge and who you've got sitting in the seats, probably yes, because it was quite a show, supposedly. There's a whole section at the back with standing space and everything for common folk to come in and watch.
Well, it's interesting because in many ways you're right that the system has changed a lot, but we almost have echoes still of that Victorian system in our magistrates court, because the Crown Court, which deals with a very, very small percentage of criminal cases, I think it's something like 5% of criminal cases, are dealt with in the Crown Court, with 95 being dealt with in the Magistrates' Court. But in the Crown Court, where you have a jury, you do generally find that things are run to a much higher and better standard than in the Victorian days. And in particular, one of those differences that you highlighted was the juries back in the day being able to determine sentence as well as determine the question of guilt or innocence, whereas nowadays juries don't deal with sentencing at all, and that's entirely a matter for the judge. But in the magistrates' court, which, as I say, deals with the overwhelming majority of crimes being much the less serious crimes, it is very similar to what you described as being the common Victorian experience. And guilty findings are rampant. It was once said to me that the only way to avoid a guilty verdict in the magistrates' court is to not have a trial in the magistrates' court, because the minute you open a trial, you're going to be convicted. And we do have, through the magistrate system, almost an echo of that Victorian jury that deals both with the question of guilt and also with the question of sentence. Because what a lot of people don't realise is that magistrates are not legally qualified. So they are just members of the public who have had a little bit of training, but no formal legal qualifications. And they're then sitting effectively in that combined role of judge and jury, deciding both on guilt and also on sentence. And what you also find, I think what you alluded to in describing the Victorian experience, is almost this sense of the conclusion being slightly inevitable, because you have a sort of posh person saying, I've been wronged, and then the jury kind of go, oh, yes, absolutely. And then what the actual defendant has to say about it probably doesn't matter a great deal. And that, unfortunately, has very much been my experience of the magistrates' court system when I used to practice in crime, because in particular, you would often have a situation where the prosecution's case was based on the evidence of police officers. So it might be, you know, I attended this place and I saw this person do this thing, and then I arrested him for theft or, you know, drink driving or whatever it might be. And then the defendant is saying, well, I didn't do it, or whatever the circumstances might be, I have an alibi or what have you. And 99 times out of 100, if the magistrates have to pick who's telling the truth between the police officer and the defendant, they will pick the police officer. So one of the very difficult things to advise about, actually advising clients in the magistrates' court, is a tricky task, because on the one hand, you can say to them, well, you know, the evidence against you is actually quite weak. And I think you would have quite a good chance of an acquittal. But nonetheless, you will not be acquitted. You will be convicted of this offence because the police officer is saying that you did it. And that's pretty much all the magistrates will require. And I did once sit in on a case. One of the strange things, again, an echo of the old Victorian system of people being able to just sort of sit at the back and watch, is quite common in the magistrates' court for there to be a big list of cases. And so if you have a case later on that day, you will just sit in the back of court and watch everyone else. And I was watching a case which was a hearing in preparation for a trial coming up. And what the defence lawyer was saying was that the evidence of a nurse who had taken a blood sample from his client and found him to be on drugs, the evidence of the nurse was not reliable. And that was his case. I hadn't taken drugs. Something's happened with the sample. The nurse has made a mistake. And the magistrate who was chairing the bench, because there's normally three magistrates sitting, he said, well, in order for your client then to make that case, he must be saying that the nurse is wrong. And the defence lawyer said, well, yes, that's right. And the magistrate said, well, we're hardly likely to find that somebody like a nurse has made a mistake, are we? And he said, well, you haven't heard any evidence yet. That's my client's case. But of course, you'll have to wait and have the nurse cross-examined. But the starting point of this bench of magistrates was, well, obviously, we're going to believe the nurse and we're not going to believe your client. And that's a very prevalent attitude amongst the magistrates, any sort of professional person, nurses, police officers, whatever it may be. And I have said many, many times that the problem with the magistrates' court and the way in which it very much has echoes of the old Victorian system is that magistrates fundamentally misunderstand their role. Juries in the Crown Court, I think, are pretty good at scrutinising evidence and actively deciding whether or not somebody is guilty or not. Magistrates don't understand their role, and most of them think that they are a part of a process, the criminal justice process, that begins with the police officer getting the right person, moving through the trial process, and then their role in the process is to effectively rubber stamp the decision that the police made months previously about whether or not they had charged the right person with the crime. So in my experience, unless there is some procedural defect in the way in which the case has been prosecuted, then magistrates don't see it as their role to undermine the police or particularly question the police about whether or not they have been diligent in the discharge of their function. And the magistrates simply see their role as part of a link in a chain rather than a stopgap and a protector to make sure that people who are wrongly accused are not convicted. So it sounds as though that sort of Victorian thing is still very much alive and well, unfortunately, albeit in the magistrates' court, which, of course, deals with mostly people that are impoverished, people that are committing crimes more out of necessity than anything else. And so we do still have very much that sort of system.
So what do you have to be to, what do you have to do to be a magistrate? You say that they're not particularly going to be anyone who is a lawyer or a barrister, but they'll have a bit of training. So like what are they looking for a magistrate?
So what they are generally looking for is anybody who feels as though they want to discharge a public service. Being a magistrate is an unpaid role. I think you have an allowance for expenses, but you don't have a paid position as a magistrate. So inevitably, it skews towards people who are either so comfortably off that they can afford to take time out of their job and sit in the magistrate's court on a Wednesday afternoon, or more often people that have retired and are looking for something to do in their retirement. So again, you end up with this almost self-selecting group of people that are considering becoming magistrates in the first place. In terms of the training that they get, when I say that they're not lawyers, but they have a bit of training, what I mean by that is it's literally the training they get as part of becoming a magistrate. So there's no expectation that you'll have done any sort of prior legal or other training. the expectation is simply that you will do that training once you've been appointed.
Well, I think I know what I'm going to do when I retire.
Well, I must admit, I mean, it does, you know, I can understand the attraction, and it does sound like a good way of doing some public service. And there are many magistrates who are genuinely committed to the concept of justice and are interested in the elements of public service. There are, unfortunately, many magistrates who simply enjoy sitting up on a high chair and looking down at endless procession of poor unfortunates whom they are tasked with judging.
Yeah, actually, that sounds like you might struggle to sleep at night with that a bit in some cases.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the biggest problems, and again, actually, you mentioned this as well, this idea that in the Victorian era, judges would turn up and they would have a lot of cases that they had to get through. And inevitably, what that would mean in the Victorian courts would be more of a focus on speed and efficiency rather than obtaining the correct result. And if I would say that there was one feature of the modern day magistrates' courts that reflects that Victorian attitude, it is exactly that. It is this idea that what is important is to get through the day's list of cases. What is less important is coming to the right result in individual cases.
So, yes, if you ever do commit a crime, try not to go to the magistrate's court where you will be judged by Mrs. Magoo, the ex-baker from down the road.
Exactly. Dean, you've been rather coy in your narration of your time at the Museum of Justice, because not just did you attend, but you were actually role-playing as the accused.
Yes. Were you not? They said, you look like a convict, and got me up to stand as in place of George Bates, and then asked someone else to be the accuser and stand up near the judge's chair, and they asked what they wanted to do, and he said that he wanted to hang me, even though we'd only just met that day. And that turned out to be the case, yes. And then we had someone walking around sort of role-playing the barrister who was talking us through. I didn't know if they were a real barrister at any time. I doubt it. But they were wearing all the garb anyway.
Oh, very nice.
Minus the wig, maybe. Maybe you're not.
Well, that's very interesting, because in the magistrates' court, it is much more common to see solicitors than barristers, because solicitors automatically have rights of audience in the magistrates' court. And solicitors traditionally would not wear wigs. That was the preserve of barristers. And you will often, even today, see people wandering around in the Crown Court where robes are still worn. In the magistrates' court now, it's business suits anyway. But in the Crown Court, you will still often see barristers in their full get-up, and then solicitors effectively wearing everything except for the wig. Because although solicitors are now entitled to wear the wig, there's still a degree of reluctance on their part to do so. It's also an interesting fact that the solicitor's gown is much less fancy than the barrister's gown. So barrister's gowns have lots of sort of pleats and buttons and things, and the solicitor's gown is a much more simple affair. So although to the untrained eye, they may look pretty much the same at court, you, dear listener, will be able to go to the Crown Court now and point out who is a barrister and who is a solicitor.
What about judges' robes? Are they even fancy in the barrister's robes?
Yes, judges' robes are very different depending on... So that there's not just one type of judge's robe either. So they are different colours and with different features depending on the level of judge that you're dealing with. So they can be all sorts of interesting things. And actually, if you go to the Royal Courts of Justice in the Strand in London, they have a small little display of both historical judicial robes and also judicial robes from other jurisdictions. And you can see how different lawyers dress through time and place.
So when you say the magistrates' courts is just business suits, do you still wear the wig with your business suit? Or do you mean literally it's just all business suits?
No, it is just business suits, unfortunately. So not even the barrister's bands. You just wear a tie. And absolutely kind of straight business suit affair. I should say, for those who are interested in this idea of what a Victorian court was like, and particularly given all that I've just said about the actual similarities between the Victorian style and the modern day magistrates' court, Birmingham Magistrates' Court still has, it runs, I think, about 15 courts in the court building there. But Birmingham Magistrates' Court is, in fact, itself an old Victorian court. It's a beautiful building made of terracotta, and it's absolutely fantastic. But they have retained, I think, three of their courts as what they call heritage courts. And they are still in the old Victorian style. So the decor is exactly as it would have been more than 100 years ago. And so if you're interested in seeing that, you can actually go nowadays to Birmingham Magistrates Court and sit in their heritage courts and watch real modern cases being tried as if they were old Victorian cases.
Oh, okay. I was going to ask that, whether they actually are still used, whether they're just there for view. I assume the one in Nottingham isn't used anymore. I don't think that building's used for anything anymore, and it actually has a prison in the back of it. So the courtroom was attached to the prison.
Yes, well, that makes sense. I mean, that's still the case with Birmingham magistrates. Actually, they have a number of cells at the back of Birmingham Magistrates Court, and most magistrates and particularly Crown Courts will have, at the very least, cells, if not a direct prison connection. But of course, for obvious reasons, if people if they're remanded in custody pending a trial, for example, then they need to be kept in cells even once they've arrived at court. So I did once do a magistrate's case where my client was going to be sentenced, and we didn't know if the judge was going to sentence him to imprisonment or if he was going to give him a non-custodial sentence. So he'd heard all of the submissions from everyone, and we were just sort of waiting while the judge was making a few notes and doing a bit of decisions. And my chap was in the dock, and they didn't have enough staff. So unusually, he was in the dock without any court officers there to sort of keep an eye on him. He was just in the dock on his own. And my chap was quite an experienced criminal. He knew the score. And after a few minutes of the judge writing notes, he then made a phone call, which we couldn't hear. And then a minute or so after that, two uniformed court prison staff came in and stood in the dock with my client, to which he went, "Oh, fuck," because he knew that the judge had phoned through to the prison and had told them to bring in two members of the prison staff because he was just about to send the chap to prison.
I imagine, like, just seeing them come through the door, you're just like, your heart would just fall out your arsehole. You'd just be like, oh no. But what you have just said is, it seems, an experienced criminal, so I imagine he would have been up against it in the first place anyway to not have got a sentence. I mean, do we have a system similar to America? Do we have like a strike system? Do we have anything like that, like the amount of times that you've been in trouble?
We do with certain offences. So with all crimes, the extent to which you have a criminal record is relevant. So if you have no criminal record previously, then you're referred to as being of good character, and that is a factor in your record of offending. The more serious subsequent offending should be treated. There isn't a general system of strikes. There is for, I think, domestic burglaries. I think if you commit three domestic burglaries, you have to go to prison for a certain period of time. But we tend not in this jurisdiction to have mandatory sentencing requirements. We tend to give judges a great deal more flexibility than they do in the States. And so we tend to have a series of guidelines and a series of ideas, and then judges are empowered to focus on the facts of the individual case and give a sentence which, in their experience and discretion, they consider to be appropriate. There are some things where certain sentences are mandatory. So drink driving is one. After, I think, your second drink driving offence, you get an extended ban as a matter of course. And as I say, with domestic burglaries, that's another one. But it's one of those things. The government often tries to seem tough on crime by saying that they're going to introduce mandatory sentences for certain things. And then it tends to face a bit of a backlash from people who actually understand the criminal justice system.
Mm, yeah. The ability to be able to take every case individually. So we'll move on from this and we'll go on to a more modern case, probably not as Victorian at all. This is employee excluded from Pizza Fridays, wins over 32,000 in compensation.
Yes, the classic Victorian case of Pizza Friday.
Yes, that's what used to happen. You didn't want to go to court on Pizza Friday because they wanted you out even quicker than usual. She could have been asked if she wanted to join in, the judge reportedly stated. This is, just says British woman, but it is a real case. I've checked it's in many different outlets. The Sun is one of them, but that's not always 100%. But no,
it's in the Sun Law Reports, and it's absolutely true.
This one is in Food and Wine.
Ah, another bastion of legal reporting.
So no one likes to feel like the office outcast, and sometimes it's the subtle snubs that stick in the most. Like a British woman who was recently awarded $32,000, I think it was about £28,000, in compensation for workplace discrimination that included being left out from Pizza Fridays. So she served as a telephone receptionist and service advisor at a Ford dealership in Hartwell. She began to have problems in the workplace over her hours, pay, and she's put gender discrimination. Yet, despite her manager being reprimanded and her being sent to a different branch in Watford, her co-workers began ostracizing her. In 2019, she left the company. And this was because they would go around and have their Pizza Fridays and would not ask her if she wanted a pizza. What was one of the main issues that she had. The defense said that apparently she finished work at 1 p.m. So, you know, that's why they didn't ask her if she wanted pizza. Which I kind of understand because, you know, would you stay late at work for pizza, Mark?
I would not, but I would at 1 o'clock be quite happy to tuck in to a Hawaiian.
Yeah, what about the pizza, Mike?
No, I mean, here's the thing that I find odd. Right. You can buy from like Asda, other providers are available, delicious, very, very cheap pizza.
Yeah.
And my heart always sinks if I'm out and, you know, we're talking about having a takeaway or going out to, you know, a restaurant or whatever it might be. And some person says, why don't we order a pizza? My heart, Dean, it sinks. Because what a waste of a takeaway.
Oh, I love
because it. Because it's 10 times the cost and no better than the pizza I could get from Asda.
Nah, a Domino's tastes completely different to any pizza you can buy.
No, no, it does. That's just what they want you to think.
No, I know it to be true, Michael.
No, you don't.
Like, I understand if you don't want to go to like generic pizza man company where they all, you know, it doesn't taste, but a Domino's is a different breed. It tastes like something else. It just does. No, and you just cannot recreate that.
I bet what you could do if you really wanted to recreate the Domino's thing is just get some fry light, you know, that spray on oil stuff and just spray an absolute ton of it around the crust of your Asda pizza. And then once it's cooked, it will be all oily and greasy, just like Domino's. And you will have saved yourself probably 30 quid.
I don't know. It's just never the right texture. You put it in the oven and it's like, it just like sometimes they're too crispy. Like, I don't want mine to taste like a breadstick. Sometimes the crust in that is like a breadstick. And you
but
want
then, if you find that all the other pizzas are different to Domino's, maybe Domino's is wrong.
But maybe I want to be wrong then.
Well, you've got me there. Yeah, you've got me there.
Well, if that's wrong, then I don't want it to be right, Mike.
Fine.
It's like penicillin, basically. They accidentally discovered something by an accident, and it just turned out to be the best version of what it is that they do. It's the only place I'm rarely ever bothered about ordering pizza from. If I go anywhere else, I like pizza. No, I don't. But yes, I will. I enjoy a Domino's.
I'll tell you the other problem with Domino's, right, is their bloody deals. because they do so many deals. And you're like, online, they're like, well, if you get two of these pizzas and this drink, you can get 10% off. But if you get one of these pizzas and one of these garlic breads and two of these drinks, you can have 9.5% off. And it's just like, oh my God, I don't know. I don't want to be spending my money in the first place. I don't want a baffling array of deals. I just want a curry.
What, from Domino's?
Yes.
Well,
that's correct.
I do find that they're definitely not helping the plight of obesity in the fact that they often, their deals, are far better off getting mountains of pizza than just, say, ordering yourself one pizza, because to get yourself, say, two large pizzas costs probably as much as individually buying yourself one large pizza, because they'll do like a 50% off deal when spending over £30 or something like that. So you basically end up buying two large pizzas when really all you wanted was one large pizza, but cost-wise, it was far more efficient to have two. So you just end up with mountains of pizza, and the more people you have and the more pizza you need, the more you save.
Exactly. So we're agreed that they should be closed down on public health grounds.
No, I'm just saying. What I'm trying to do here is justify the fact that I have to order two large pizzas every time I go to Domino's.
Although I will say, in fairness to Domino's, I once had their like cheese stuffed crust,
mm-hmm.
and that, by God, was an absolute triumph. I thoroughly enjoyed that, I have to say.
Did you ever see when they had the hot dog stuffed crust?
I did see that, and that to me was a step too far. Sometimes you've just got to save people from themselves, and I don't think Domino's should have been allowed to sell that.
I think it was a natural evolution. I think people looked at it and they went, it's usually one of the first things that comes across. It's like a small sort of like breaded hole, stick a hot dog in it.
Well, that's true, but then if you wanted toad in the hole, just cook a toad in the hole. Don't have a toad in the hole with pizza. It just doesn't make sense. And when you say that it's a natural evolution, are you suggesting that sort of things naturally gravitate towards putting hot dogs in them? And that's just sort of the way things develop.
Well,
so
yeah,
soon because, we'll just see hot dogs
in
it.
It's the shape of the hot dog, isn't it? Like, you're not going to stick a burger in it.
No, that is true. But you could put celery. You could put links of traditional sausage. You could do like one whole long link of sausage, like a Cumberland, if you like. That could be in there.
The Cumberland pizza.
Yeah. Or you could get sausage rolls and stuff those in for like an extra carbohydrate treat. So you've got the actual crust, then you've got puff pastry, then you've got sausage.
So basically what we're saying is there needs to be some sort of crossover where Domino's and Greg's work on a special pizza. See?
Yes.
You're going for it now. Now I can see you. You're contemplating ordering a Domino's. I can see it in your eyes.
I am. I'm genuinely thinking about driving down to Asda and buying myself a pizza for lunch.
Oh, you've ruined it now.
Yeah. Speaking of natural evolutions, have you heard of this thing called, I think it's called carcination?
Continue. I might have.
It's an evolutionary thing, right? Which is that, you know, crabs?
Yeah.
There have been, I think, 7 or 8 examples of crabs, of animals evolving into crabs independently. And evolutionary biologists have concluded that the crab is the ultimate evolutionary development. And that's the only reason why all of these completely independent animals all over the world, over time, have all evolved into the same thing that we would recognize as crabs. They're actually not related animals. It's just a natural evolution that they just become crabs.
Is that stating that there is a chance that one day eventually the human species will evolve into giant crabs?
Well, that's my natural inference from that, is that we are just going to become crabby.
We'll just start getting like tougher skin, and that's all this moisturizing your skin is just... It's just fighting against the inevitable.
Exactly, yes, exactly. They should put that on the adverts. They should say, look, we all know that we're going to become crabs. You need to soften your skin and stop Mother Nature from turning you into a crab.
There we go. So you heard it here first. We're all turning into crabs. One day there'll just be just different types of crabs everywhere. There'll be flying crabs and big crabs, small crabs, dog crabs.
You started sounding a little bit like Bubba from Forrest Gump when he's talking about shrimp.
We got shrimp salad, shrimp toast.
So, I took us away from this poor lady and her not being invited to Pizza Friday.
Yeah, so basically it seems like she's just sort of generally being left out of things in the office and felt slightly isolated due to the fact that she was part-time. I think she believed that other people, they wanted a full-time position in that role and a way to get rid of her. And the final straw was the lack of pizza on the Friday, and she managed to sue and get £28,000.
I mean, this is one of those interesting things, because when you hear the headline, you think, really? Compensation for not being invited to Pizza Friday? But what becomes apparent through your reading of the tale is that actually, I'm assuming that the claim she made for gender discrimination succeeded because it was mentioned in your reportage. And this is the thing. It's a series of events, isn't it? Of which Pizza Friday is but one. And if you see it in its proper context, which is woman is bullied out of job, partly because she's a woman and partly because everyone has just decided to freeze her out, then it becomes much easier to understand how she managed to get compensation. These things are often misreported with the idea that, you know, if you are slighted on one occasion by your co-workers all doing something and not inviting you, that gives you an entitlement to claim damages. And then people say, oh, well, the world's gone mad. If I don't want to invite Maureen from accounts to bowling, then I should be able to do that. And you still can. But what you cannot do is, as an employer, decide you need to get rid of Maureen from accounts, and therefore you're going to make her life hell. Because Maureen from accounts, I've heard, is actually quite nice.
Yes. I mean, it could work the opposite way. Maureen from accounts has some sort of gluten intolerance. You force her to eat pizza.
Well, there's that, isn't there? I mean, can you imagine an employment tribunal claim on the basis that you were force-fed pizza by your employer who knew you were gluten intolerant and just kept making you eat pizza?
I think actually she'd end up with more money than this lady.
I've no doubt that she would, but there is the danger that she might die.
Or unless she felt that there was pressure on her to eat the pizza to fit in. And if she turned down the pizza, then people would treat her differently.
Yeah, exactly. If she was like, you know, I walked in to my office and it was all decorated with pepperoni, and then 50 people from the workplace came in and they all had pizzas and they were going, Maureen. And then they were kind of throwing pizza slices at her. You would feel under pressure, I think. Yeah.
And someone just sort of walks past and just makes like a little note, like a little sarky comment, like, you could never possibly be anyone in this office if you didn't like pizza. You'd feel...
Exactly.
You'd feel that you'd need to risk your life for it.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And I think then, you know, you'd have a good shout, wouldn't you, at being pushed out of your job.
So there you go. There's a warning to any managers listening to this. Don't force your colleagues to eat pizza, but also don't leave them out from eating pizza. There's a fine pizza line, and we have to tread it. Otherwise, it can end in lawsuits.
Yes, that's right. Invite Maureen, but don't make her go if she repeatedly says no.
Yes, and don't ignore the other lady just because she's part-time. She could always take some pizza home with her.
Exactly. That's one of the joys of pizza, is that it travels perfectly well.
So we'll go on to our last section now, which is I Call Bullshit. I Call Bullshit is where I present a case to Michael. It may be a real case. It may be a form of meme or something that's gone around the internet. And it's up to Michael to let me know if he thinks it is bullshit or not. So I'll just give you the basic information, Mike, and you can let me know.
Okay.
In April a Georgia man accidentally shot his mother-in-law when he fired a pistol at an armadillo. The bullet killed the animal, but it also ricocheted off of it, hit a fence, went through the back door of his mother-in-law's mobile home, through a recliner she was sitting in, and into her back.
I don't think this is true. And the only reason I don't think it's true is because of the number of things this bullet went through and how long a journey it took. Because that suggests to me that he's not just like firing a kind of domestic gun, but he's instead firing some sort of high-powered assault rifle at this armadillo. Because it pinged off the armadillo but still killed it, then went through the open door? Is that right?
Ricocheted off of the armadillo, went through the back door of his mother-in-law's mobile home, through a recliner she was sitting in, and into her back.
Okay, this is really important. When you say through the back door, was the back door open?
It actually doesn't specify.
This is, if you'll forgive the expression, a real shot in the dark for me then. But I'm going to say this is bullshit because I just don't think that it would have had that much power. I think it would have just sort of pinged out, and maybe I could get the, if it was hits the armadillo, ricochets off, hits mother-in-law in the face because she happens to be standing next to the armadillo. We've all been there. That makes sense. But all this pinging about like, that Arnold Schwarzenegger film, Stop or My Mum Will Shoot, which is a very much underrated film. I don't think that's true.
That was also Sylvester Stallone. Just don't know.
Oh, yeah, wait a minute. It was Sylvester Stallone, wasn't it?
There's a famous thing that him and Arnie sort of had a bit of a fallout over it because Arnie made out he was going to go for it, even though it ended up being a flop, just so Sylvester Stallone would take it because he knew that Sly and him were in competition. So basically, he pretended he was going to go do the film and he was interested in it. So Sly would go for it and Sly would think he'd win, even though Arnie knew it would be a flop. So he basically forced him to have it. Yeah, they're all good friends now, but they were very, very competitive back then. And yeah, he sort of played it. He basically played Sylvester Stallone so that he was in that movie and not him.
It's a good film, though, I have to say. I really enjoy it. I don't know why it flopped.
It's just one of those cheesy, enjoyable films. You don't get many of them these days. Or the cheese is just too much. It is true.
Not unlike a Domino's.
It is true. This Georgia man did shoot at an armadillo and it ricocheted off and hit his mother-in-law. So the shooter was about 100 yards away from the mobile home. They determined, though, later that 74-year-old Carol Johnson, that's his mother-in-law, she wasn't severely injured. So although he was arrested, she didn't place any charges, didn't file any charges against him. And anyway, this is like Georgia. So, you kind of think, shooting armadillos and that is sort of everyday thing. And the investigator said just the circumstances, just all the way around, the whole situation was unusual.
yes, but that's an understatement.
He even put underneath, and this is the investigator, and it shows the sort of thought process in this area. I really think if they're going to shoot at varmints and whatnot, maybe use a shotgun with a spread pattern with a lot less range.
Sound advice from the local constabulary there. Yeah, why not use a shotgun?
Just absolutely demolish the armadillo.
What's not clear to me though, right? Because I don't think I've ever seen an armadillo in real life. Mm-hmm. And if I have, it would have been very much confined to a zoo. But I'm not aware, and this could be, this could be another honey badger scenario where I simply don't know their reputation, but I don't associate armadillos with being particularly in need of being instantly murdered. I mean, why did this guy need to shoot the armadillo?
I don't know.
Let it go about his business?
Well, they've put it as like varmint. So I'm guessing they're just a bit like, I wouldn't say a rat, but you know how like they might shoot like rabbits on their land, or same way like people might shoot pigeons or whatever, or squirrels.
Well,
I think it's just a thing. It's just like, oh, there's an armadillo on the land, shoot it. Maybe turn it into a bowl.
So really what he was doing, he was starting an art exhibition. But he just needed something to do the bottle.
Well, actually, the way I found this story was sort of by accident. I was watching the Texas Chainsaw Massacre the other day, the original, and right at the start of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, there's an armadillo dead on the road, like upside down on the road. And I was just sort of interested because it's like a 1974 cheap horror movie, like independent film. And in the 70s, I imagine that most things that were on there were as real as they could get it. And I was just wanted to know if it was a real dead armadillo at the start or whether someone had actually bothered to create this fake armadillo. Because I assume, like, while they're out, he probably saw it dead on the road and used it as a sort of establishing shot. Like, yes. That's kind of how I see those kind of old films in the 70s being filmed, where most stuff was, you know, pretty real if it was there. If it was like, you know, if someone shot a rabbit in a film, they probably shot a rabbit in a film in that kind of era. And I don't know why, but I often ask myself questions like that and decide to search it up. And then I came across the story of the man. But what's even better about this story is this one isn't a crime, but this is the second time this year that an armadillo shooting has gone awry. So this has the sort of heading of Texas man shoots at armadillo, but the varmint got him back.
I was going to say, did the armadillo retaliate?
Well, no, and this Texas man ended up in the hospital after he fired a gun at an armadillo. The bullet bounced off the animal's back, hit the man in the face.
Blimey. Hold on. If armadillos, like their sort of skin or shell or whatever it actually is, if it is so good that it causes bullets to ricochet off it, why aren't we all equipping our soldiers with armadillo plating?
Well, the first one, he killed it. It sort of ricocheted off. So that's more of like I think we want to prevent the death of people.
It's not just a ricochet, is it?
Whereas, like, that's more of a Hail Mary, isn't it? That's like when you play Call of Duty and you get that perk that leaves a grenade on the ground when you get killed.
Yes, that's true.
It'll ricochet. But actually what we want is for the bullets not to kill at all.
Yes, you're right. In an ideal world, that would be the solution.
So, I mean, this guy must really hate armadillos. So the East Texas man ended up in hospital. He fought a gun at an armadillo, bounced off someone's back, hit him in the face. They said that the shooting took place on a man's property in Texas about 3 a.m. So I imagine there was some alcohol involved here. Yeah. His wife was in the house. And he went outside. He took his .38 revolver, shot three times at the armadillo. So, like, he was really unhappy with this armadillo. I don't know what it had done. I don't know if it had been selling drugs in the local area.
Just snuffling through the neighbourhood with a load of crack.
Oh, he said, what drove the man to shoot the critter? He told authorities he had seen the animal previously on the highway, which, for reasons unexplained, prompted him to draw his weapon and pull the trigger. I don't understand what that is, his reasoning. I saw him previously on the highway. Like, was the armadillo driving? Did he cut him off?
Maybe, like, cut him up at some traffic lights.
Yeah. Just like, he's like, oh, you bastard. And then he sees him near his land and walks out of his revolver at 3 a.m.
How could you possibly know if it's the same armadillo?
Exactly, yeah. Either he's literally gone home, seen it just before, gone home to get his gun just to shoot it. But it said it was on his land. So this armadillo followed him out, a smug look
and a twinkle in its eye. And he was like, he knows. He knows who I am.
Well, one of the bullets then ricocheted off the bony protective shell and struck the man in his jaw.
Oof.
Yeah.
Ironically, his bony protective shell is on the inside.
Yes. But so he used his jaw to stop a bullet. Rowe told the wire service that the injury was serious enough that the gunman had to be airlifted to a nearby hospital where doctors wired his jaw shut. The armadillo's condition remains a mystery.
Well, I mean, hopefully it's alive and well and driving up and down the freeway without a care in the world.
I just imagine it's like gone back to its mates and it's got like these like bullet holes in it. It's like the 50 cent of armadillos. It's just been... it's survived the shooting.
The armadillo actually has like a shell. Is it like a turtle then, an armadillo? Like, where are armadillos from? Like, what is
like,
an armadillo?
Like areas like Texas and that, I think.
Right.
And like, they're sort of like, and maybe like Mexico sort of area.
Yeah, Mexico sounds right. Wasn't there, didn't there used to be a thing? I'm thinking of dime bars.
Yeah, dime bars
soft
and
on
an
the
armadillo.
Inside, crunchy on the outside like an armadillo.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I've never tried to eat an armadillo. Crunchy on the outside.
I mean, in fairness, given these experiences, I don't think I'd want to get anywhere near to an armadillo because it just seems as though they're just more hassle than they're worth.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I always thought they looked kind of like cool. And like,
yeah.
If I saw a little armadillo, but then again, I guess it's just one of those things where if you don't actually live in the areas where these things exist, you don't know how they sort of play into the local ecosystem. Maybe they're like absolute wankers.
Well, that's true. I mean, do you think there are people in like Texas looking at pictures of pigeons in, you know, Croydon and going, oh, these little birds, they seem like great fun. I don't know why everyone in England hates pigeons.
Do you reckon there are pigeons in Texas? Like our sort of
I don't know.
They seem like a kind of, I don't know.
I always think of pigeons as a peculiarly British phenomenon.
Oh, they're in like New York and places like that.
Oh, that's true. But did they come over on the Mayflower?
What, just the pigeons travelling about?
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm going to get different types of pigeons, don't they? Like wood pigeon, and they've probably got fancier pigeons in America.
See, what other kind of pigeons are there? Because everyone always says wood pigeon. And I don't think there are any other pigeons.
I don't know.
So I suppose in the modern world, you would have like skyscraper pigeons. Traffic pigeons.
Armadillo pigeons
just swooping down and plucking armadillos from fields.
Shoot it from the sky and it just ricochets back, smacks you in the jaw.
Can you imagine if anyone had ever created, or if you will, God had evolved, a sort of armoured flying creature, like an armadillo with wings? How terrifying would that be?
I guess it's more about the weight, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose. But you could have it like... You could have it like hollow, so it's actually quite light. Would that work?
I don't know. Well, for it to be terrifying enough, then I would imagine like the hollow, like it would have to be a tough enough shell to care. Otherwise, it's just like a flying egg, isn't it?
Yeah, that's true. That is less terrifying.
Yeah, like just look at it. It's got a big shell. It's kind of scary looking. And the minute you like poke it with a stick, it cracks.
How good would that be, though, if you had flying eggs and you could literally just kind of like shepherd them into your kitchen? Just crack them over.
That sounds more horrific than just getting an egg. You're literally being a little animal and just beating it to death over the frying pan.
Yeah, I had this sort of like Snow White idea in my mind of just sort of like having the animals in the house and everything. But then, yeah, when you sort of think about it, it is genuinely quite horrific.
Yeah, I don't remember the part of Snow White where the animals are flying around her and then she had a veal steak.
She's just wringing the neck of a bluebird. Yeah, no, that's fair. That's fair.
But so I will leave it there for this week. We have now discussed not to go hunting armadillos. So definitely wouldn't use an air rifle on it even kill it with a revolver. So there's an armadillo out there that's been shot 3 times, the absolute gangster armadillo. There's a dead armadillo that got its own back on the mother-in-law of a gentleman in Georgia. So stay away from armadillos, people.
But
by dime bars or dame bars. The dame now? D-A-I-M.
Dame? Because they're spelt dame. But I've always called them dime.
Yeah, but I think they actually used to be called dime. I think it's like a marathon and a Snickers.
Oh, okay. I hadn't appreciated that. I thought it was just a sort of weird accent thing.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know why they had to change the name. Like someone got mistaken. Yeah. Like they're in their pocket and they're like, so what used to happen was in America, you'd go to the cinema and someone would be like, oh yeah, well, not the cinema, whatever costs a dime. And they're like, oh, that's a dime. And they kept accidentally pulling out chocolate bars. And they're like, no, we mean the currency. And they're like, oh, I just can't get my head around this. And so they had to change the name of it.
It was just an avalanche of angry letters to Dime HQ being like, you've got to change the name of this thing.
Yeah, I keep hours trying to pay with chocolate bars. Even though I assume the chocolate bars probably cost more than a dime.
I would have thought so. What actually is a dime? I don't understand American money.
I don't understand American money. But I know it's just like change, isn't it? Like pennies. Yeah. I think they have a penny, they have a dime, they have a nickel.
Well, they have cents, don't they? They have cents and dollars. Oh, I get that.
Cents.
And then you have like dimes and nickels and other things. I don't know. Why can't they just call it the amount of the money it is? Like we do with 50p pieces.
Yeah. It's like our old system though, isn't it? Like a shilling and a crown.
But we got rid of that. Stop being weird, America.
Well, I think they do. I think they have like cents. They will have like one to whatever cents. I guess is it like 100? I'm imagining it's like a pound. It's like 100 cents for a dollar.
Yeah.
And then like a nickel is just like 25 cents. Maybe it's just a nickname for it. It must be what it's made out of. Is it made out of nickel?
I have no idea. But yes, if you're listening from America, please tell us, do you have a lot of pigeons? And tell us what your currency is actually all about, because it makes no sense.
And also, if you're aware of why armadillos are so hated, we would also like to know that information. That'd be good.
Yeah. And feel free to tell us in confidence, because you don't want a gang of angry armadillos turning up at your ranch.
So I'm going to leave it there for today. Is there anything you'd like to say before we leave, Mike?
Yes, just on the subject of terrifying animals, if you've never seen, dear listener, I think it's called the coconut crab, but it might be called the coconut spider, but it's one of those two things, and it is easily the most terrifying animal I have ever seen in my life. So if you're interested in being terrified, then have a look at one of those, because they will absolutely give you plenty of fuel for your nightmares. So that's the only thing that I wanted to add. This week.
I just had a look at it. It's pretty horrific. Also, on that same note, look up the camel spider.
Oh, dear.
That's even more terrifying.
Okay, I'm going to do this right now. I'm going to do some live research. Camel spider. Oh, God. I actually really don't like spiders, though. The first result is giant camel spider.
Yeah.
No, thank you.
So we'll end the episode there with the screams of pain from Michael Develi, and he's just looked up a camel spider. We hope you enjoyed this week's episode, and we hope you'll join us again next week.
Goodbye, everybody.
If you know of any strange court or legal cases you would like us to discuss on the show, feel free to email us at holding.court@outlook.com.